Thank you, Vice Chancellor, for those kind words. The subtitle of the lecture is actually what was going to be the subtitle of the book, but after an altercation, if that's the right word, a discussion with the publishers, it was changed. And perhaps you'll understand why it was changed after I've held forth. One might think that after 60 years and more, the main outlines of the Second World War would have been firmly established, and that historians would by now only have been dealing with the details. My strong impression, however, is that exactly the opposite is true. That in this age of ultra-specialization, most historians have taken to poring over the details without waiting for the all-important framework to emerge. I think that this unfortunate state of affairs is one of the products of the Cold War, when the gulf between knowledge and attitudes in Western Europe and Eastern Europe was never bridged. In other words, many of us still can't see the wood for the trees. The disparity of views about the Second World War, especially in official and popular circles, was put on worldwide show last year during the 60th anniversary commemorations. In Washington, D.C., a national World War II memorial was unveiled, of course, with the inscription 1941-45. But be that as it may, the thing that really struck me, and I walked round the memorial very conscientiously, there's no mention at all of the United States having had any allies at all in the war. At Auschwitz, in January of last year, the President of Poland presided over a ceremony marking the liberation of the Nazi German concentration camp that had been built there in 1940 on German-occupied Polish territory. And once again, everything at first looked fine. And yet, nobody, either at the ceremony or in the many press comments that surrounded the event, nobody mentioned what was actually going on in the so-called liberation of Poland. What was actually happening was that one set of concentration camps were being liberated, and at the selfsame time, other concentration camps and sometimes ex-Nazi concentration camps were being filled up by a new generation of prisoners. In Moscow in May, the president of Russia, Vladimir Putin, took the salute atop Lenin's mausoleum for a military parade staged in period uniforms. Again, at first sight, everything was in order. But if you look closely, there were many things that were not quite right. For example, although Mr. Putin didn't make this mistake, nearly all the Western press talked about Russia having fought in the war, whereas, of course, Russia was one of 15 Soviet republics. And right behind Mr. Putin on that ceremony was the president of Ukraine, Yushchenko, whose father, incidentally, had been a prisoner in Auschwitz. And yet no mention at all was made of the non-Russian Soviet republics. Finally, in London in July, there was a memorial concert that you may remember, a television light-hearted show, which is fine. It was attended by the Prime Minister and by the Queen and other dignitaries, and it was an evocation of the wartime years, wartime songs, wartime speeches of Churchill and so on. But once again, if you look closely, there was hardly any mention at all of who was fighting with us in 1939 to 45. In reality, as I hope you know, it was the British Empire that was at war in 1939. And yet the contributions of the Australians, the New Zealanders, the South Africans, the Canadians, and many more, got no mention. The whole framework within which the war is envisioned at the present time seems to be shrinking, it seems to be narrowing. The focus of our memories seems to be shortening. It's not my intention this evening to summarize the historiography of the Second World War, which I couldn't probably pull off if I tried. But a few years back, I did write a piece in the New York Review about a large book by one Gerhard Weinberg, A World at Arms, which was fairly widely acclaimed as the best and fullest overview to date. In my review of this book, whilst praising its good qualities, I did say that, in my view, it was a prime example of a mindset that I had elsewhere defined as the Allied scheme of history. This scheme consists of half a dozen rarely questioned assumptions deriving from British and American experience in two world wars. And these assumptions would include the superiority of something called Western civilization, the ideology of anti-fascism, the demonization of Germany, the indulgence of Russia in general, and of Stalinism in particular, in other words, the Uncle Joe syndrome, and lastly, the acceptance of a permanent division in Europe between East and West. Before that, and before I really begin, I want to keep you awake by posing two or three questions which may possibly test your knowledge and which may help illuminate what I'm going to be talking about. I won't be calling for answers now, but if the Vice Chancellor permits, we might try to answer them afterwards. The first question, they're disarmingly simple. The first one is, can you name the five, or better, the 10 biggest battles of the Second World War? And sub-question, where on a scale of 1 to 10 would you put Operation Overlord, in other words, the campaign in Normandy that started on D-Day? 10 battles, and where in those 10 would you put Overlord? The second, can you name the largest concentration camp operating in Europe in 1939 to 45? Simple question, simple answer. Three, can you name the European nationality that suffered the largest number of civilian casualties during the war? Big biggest battle, biggest concentration camp, biggest group of war dead. Having done that, we must move on. I was really wanted to draw your attention to three issues that I think obstruct all our attempts to establish a more impartial narrative. And these three headings that I'll be talking to are, first, language, the language we use in talking about the Second World War. Secondly, proportions. And thirdly, criminality. First thing is language. Language reflects the way we think. And the way we think about the Second World War is often revealed by the terminology used, and, of course, by the accepted definition of terms. I fear, however, that our usage is not always impartial. There is, here in Britain, and even more in America, a tendency to conceptualize conflicts in simplistic, moralistic, Manichaean terms, where our good is seen to be fighting courageously against the evil of the enemy. This bipolar black and white scenario is understandable and may even be necessary in wartime, but it is being carried on into peacetime, present-day discourse. What is more, and to my mind particularly interesting, it blends very well with the similarly black and white dialectic of past Soviet attitudes that excused anything done in the name of anti-fascism and that blamed all ills on the machinations and misdeeds of the fascist enemy. The upshot is a somewhat self-righteous and rather uncritical posture that is a very real obstacle to understanding and explaining what really happened. For example, when I first visited the Soviet bloc in the 1960s, having left Brighton to do so, I was extremely shocked to find that communist propaganda attributed all war crimes exclusively to Nazi Germany. I was well aware, as I hope you are, of the enormity of Nazi crimes. Yet the official attitude was, there's nothing else to talk about. War criminals were ipso facto Nazis or Nazi collaborators, and this was a pretense that was manifestly untrue. Nonetheless, a still bigger shock came, I think, many years later, when the British War Crimes Act of 1991 took exactly the same hypocritical line. In its wisdom, our British Parliament passed an act which limits the definition of a war crime to an act either committed by Germans or on German-occupied territory. The inbuilt bias, I think, should be self-evident. It means that in many countries of Eastern Europe, a few elderly Latvians or Lithuanians, should we say, could be hounded for implication in massacres perpetrated under German auspices, whilst other people implicated in other massacres perpetrated by other authorities could not even be investigated. According to British law, and this is what really shocked me, according to British law, the cold-blooded shooting of 22,000 Allied officers in the spring of 1940, now fully documented, does not even constitute a war crime. It's clear, I think, that laws in a democratic country reflect prevailing attitudes. But it's also true that the existence of laws and of legal definitions helps to condition us to a particular way of thinking, a way of thinking that the lawmakers want to preserve. The other side of the coin to war crimes is victimhood. And there's a considerable ongoing controversy about who is and who is not allowed to regard themselves as victims. One might like to think that a victim is anyone who has been victimized, who has been made to suffer unjustly. In practice, things are rather different. If one takes the Manichaean model, the black and white show, the enemy are bad men, and bad men who suffer are suffering justly because they are bad or because they belong to a nation that behaved badly. Such ways of thinking invite stereotypes on a grand scale. With the exception of a few black sheep, the British and Americans are seen to be good because they were fighting for the good cause. Germans, with a few exceptions, were bad because they voted for Hitler and because they supposedly started the war single-handed. Russians are usually seen to be good because they fought the Germans heroically. Ukrainians are bad because some of them were collaborators or concentration camp guards. In reality, there are actually more Russians in the Waffen SS than there were Ukrainians. But let's not confuse the issue. Above all, there is great resistance to the idea that million-strong nations can be regarded as aggressors in one respect and as victims in another respect, or that a nation of victims can also produce monsters, criminals, and murderers. Generally speaking, people don't seem to like complexity. They often prefer simplicity and clarity, even when these simplicities are inappropriate. Even after 60 years, it is still difficult to raise the same sympathy for the thousands of German children who were incinerated by Allied bombing as it is to talk of our own people incinerated by the Blitz. Even in Germany, it's difficult for the millions of German expellees who lost their homes in the East to be seen as the victims of injustice. And the issue of millions of German women gang raped by the Allied armies, and by one Allied army in particular, was swept under the carpet for decades. Proportions. From the initial attack on Poland in September 1939 to the storming of Berlin by the Red Army in April 1945, the fighting in Europe consisted of long chains of operations which stretched from the North Cape of Norway to to the western desert in Libya, from Brittany in the west to Chechnya in the east. Each combatant power had its own particular stake in these operations, and historians tend to pick and choose what they want to what they wish to emphasize. British and American historians tend to pay special attention to those theaters of action where British and American troops were deployed, hence to North Africa, to Italy, to the Western Front. They don't deny exactly the importance of the Eastern Front, but they present a picture where the Reich, the Third Reich, is pincered from west and from east, and they often imply, without actually saying so, that the balance between the Western and the Soviet war efforts was more or less 50-50. Weinberg, who I mentioned, actually apologized in his introduction for not giving due weight to the Eastern Front. Proportions, however, are crucial. One cannot judge the relative weight of particular episodes without determining the size and strength of forces deployed in all the episodes. And here, inquiring Westerners are in for a shock. For example, the volume of troops engaged in the German-Soviet conflict on the Eastern Front, measured in man months, works out at a total of 406 million. This compares with 16.5 million for the Western Front in 1944-45. 406 against 17. In other words, the fighting on the Eastern Front appears to have been at least 10 times greater than the fighting on all the other fronts put together. What is more, since 75 to 80% of all German losses were inflicted on the Eastern Front, it follows that the efforts of the Western Allies accounted for perhaps 20 to 25%. Furthermore, since the British Army deployed a maximum of 28 divisions compared with the 99 of the US Army, the British contribution to the defeat of the Wehrmacht must have been somewhere in the region of 5 to 6%. British people who imagined that we won the war have something to think about. The modest size of the American contingent also calls for reflection. The population of the USA was over twice that of Germany and not far short of the Soviet Union's. The USA military potential, as estimated in 1939 in terms of GNP and industrial production, represented more than 40% of the world's total. Yet these colossal advantages were never translated into proportionate superiority on the battlefield, particularly in Europe. The 100 divisions which General Marshall and his staff set as their target for mobilization were overshadowed 2.5 to 1 by the number of German divisions and by 3 to 4 to 1 by the number of Red Army divisions. As a result, when the Reich was fighting for its life in 1944-5, the German General Staff allocated less than one-third of its total strength to the Western Front and almost three-quarters to the East. As General Eisenhower came to realize very quickly, his armies were seriously undermanned. They relied far too heavily on air power and could rarely assemble the local concentrations that were required for a sustained offensive. Even before the setbacks at Arnhem and the Battle of the Bulge, the progress of our armies had been painfully slow. The context of the Yalta Conference, when Stalin was virtually handed Eastern Europe on a plate, was largely determined by demands from Washington for major troop transfers to the Far East. In the absence of the A-bomb, the Americans were staring at the possibility of a million casualties if Japan, the main islands of Japan, were to be stormed. And Stalin's Red Army was the only possible candidate for making up the shortfall. So Stalin had to be humored. At that stage, the Western Allies were hard-pressed to maintain momentum on their approach to the Rhine, and no reserves to spare for curbing the Soviets, even if that had been wished for. In the end, very much to the anger of both Churchill and Montgomery, the US commanders took the unilateral decision to let Marshal Zhukov capture Berlin single-handed. There was very little other alternative. Of course, crude numbers and troop levels do not explain everything. The Western powers were strong in some departments, notably in naval and air forces, and less strong in others. American industrial output was one of the marvels of the war, and all members of the Allied coalition, including the Soviet Union, benefited greatly from lend-lease deliveries. The Battle of the Atlantic and the strategic air offensive were very definite, significant contributions to the war. Nonetheless, the Third Reich was not brought to its knees by bombers or blockades. Both the German military and the German civilian population proved remarkably resilient. Hitler's continental fortress had to be reduced inch by inch by soldiers on the ground. And it was exactly in that department that the Red Army excelled. Nor should one imagine that Soviet victories can be attributed to numerical superiority alone. It's perfectly true that Stalin's marshals could sustain a casualty rate that far surpassed that of any other army. They regularly lost two or three men for every German soldier killed, and they still came out on top. In all probability, this is another curious fact, more Red Army men were shot by the NKVD, i.e. Stalin's security force, as one says, for repetition, deviation, or hesitation. More shot by the NKVD than the total number of Germans killed by the Western armies in combat. Even so, the Soviet war machine was supported by remarkable logistical, industrial, and technological achievements. Having seen how tiny Finland had parried the Bolshevik hordes during the Winter War of 1939-40, German commanders had been lulled into believing that Operation Barbarossa would be a walkover, and many other experts agreed with them. Kick in Russia's front door, the Führer had declared, or words to that effect, and the whole house will collapse. In the event, reality proved otherwise. Despite occupying an area as large as Western Europe, the German forces left 95% of the Soviet Union untouched. And the Soviets had more than enough space in which to recuperate and to reorganize. Steelworks, arm factories, supply centers were relocated beyond the Germans' reach in Siberia or in the Urals. Tanks, guns, and warplanes never ceased to pour off the production lines, and surprisingly, their quality was often as impressive as their quality. The matchless T-34 tanks, the most versatile of the war, took on the panzers and won. Soviet artillery was particularly professional. The Katyusha rocket launchers hurled far more metal at the Wehrmacht than the Wehrmacht could hurl back. Even Soviet aviation, which seemed to have been knocked out in 1941, recovered well. By the last phase of the war, the Red Air Force was flying more home-built modern fighters and bombers than the RAF was. In other words, the Soviet triumph was based on a solid all-round performance, not simply on numbers and brutality. What I'm saying on this point is that the defeat of the Third Reich cannot be attributed either to the forces of Western democracy or to members of the coalition in equal measure. Whether we like it or not, the principal contribution came from the Red Army. Part of the explanation lies in timing. The Red Army was knocking the guts out of the Wehrmacht's offensive capacity already at the Battle of Kursk in July 1943. At the very same time, I think at the very same day as the first British and American soldiers landed on the continent on the distant shores of Sicily. By the time of D-Day, June 1944, the Red Army was already inside the Greater Reich. And by the time that Zhukov was standing on the River Oder in January 1945, only 40 miles from Berlin, the Western armies were still 2 months away from reaching the Rhine. Sorry, from crossing the Rhine. Not yet possessing the A-bomb, the USA was nowhere near, at this stage, near parity in Europe. In essence, Stalin had between 6 and 7 months to spare, and he used it for conquering Eastern Europe in the months while the Western powers still struggled to crawl towards Germany. So much, I think, may be reluctantly conceded by Western analysts who can do their sums. A still tougher obstacle derives from the fact that Soviet military prowess went hand in hand with criminality. The Third Reich, whose own criminal nature is universally accepted, was largely defeated by the forces of another mass-murdering tyranny. The liberators of Auschwitz were servants of a regime that ran a much larger network of concentration camps of its own. At the Nuremberg Tribunal, the victorious Allies established new definitions of criminal conduct by which to try the surviving Nazi leaders. It would have been too much, of course, to expect them to apply the same standards in court to themselves, that is, to the wartime conduct of the Allied countries. Yet the Nuremberg principles are universal and widely respected, and there is no reason why historians should not use them as a measure for the policy, for gauging the policies and actions of all combatant states. Three categories of international crime were identified at Nuremberg: crimes against peace, i.e., wars of aggression, premeditated wars of aggression; war crimes perpetrated in the course of military action; and thirdly, crimes against humanity. This last category was entirely new at the time and was inspired by the need to judge the unprecedented body of evidence about Nazi racial policies. In 1946, the word genocide had barely been invented and the term Holocaust had not yet acquired its current meaning. In the decades since Nuremberg, various accusations have been levelled against the Allied powers without them ever being tried, let alone proven. The authors of the strategic bombing offensive, for example, which killed hundreds of thousands of German civilians, have frequently been charged with the indiscriminate or excessive use of force. The US authorities have also been blamed for massive mortality among German prisoners of war in 1945, and the international decision taken at Potsdam to expel the entire German population of lands allocated to Poland, Czechoslovakia and Romania has since been likened to ethnic cleansing. The final upshot is uncertain. Yet whilst the crimes of the Third Reich rightly stand condemned for all time, the strong impression lingers that the full panoply of wartime criminality has never been properly dealt with. With regard to crimes of the first category, for instance, crimes against peace, it's quite clear that Stalin was no less guilty than Hitler. The USSR was expelled from the League of Nations in 1939 for its war of aggression against Finland, and its annexations of the three Baltic states in June 1940 were blatant instances of aggression. Most importantly, however, it's vital to realize that the Second World War could not even have started without Stalin colluding with Hitler. The Nazi-Soviet Pact and the Nazi-Soviet Treaty of 1939 were the necessary instruments for overthrowing the international order. And they gave the same license for banditry to Stalin in the East that they gave to Hitler in the West. Yet our textbooks continue to present it all misguidedly as Hitler's war. Nowadays, we even know what Stalin was calculating in August 1939. He was counting on a long war of attrition between Germany and the Western powers, which he could then subsequently exploit. in his speech to the Politburo of 19th of August 1939, which came to light not very long ago, he even speculated that the Nazis, having been defeated in the West, could be overthrown by a communist coup in Berlin, which of course would be much to his advantage. As we know, that never happened. With regard to the other categories of crime, much more is known today than 60 years ago. And again, by far the most significant developments have occurred in the Soviet field. When Churchill was writing in the late 1940s, he knew perfectly well that Stalin was no angel. Yet the sheer scale and variety of Stalinist crimes, both inside the USSR and abroad, had been carefully concealed and have only been uncovered slowly and piecemeal. Khrushchev's secret speech, for example, which for the first time officially denounced Stalin's crimes, was only made in 1956, and it raised as many questions as it gave answers. Solzhenitsyn's detailed revelations about the Gulag only reached the English-speaking world in the 1970s. Robert Conquest's pioneering books about the Great Terror, the Ukrainian famine, or the nation killers were systematically contested by Soviet apologists who long muddied the waters. And the cold-blooded shooting of over 20,000 Allied officers, which I mentioned, was consistently denied until President Gorbachev's confession in 1990. Indeed, the Soviet Union itself had to collapse before many matters were fully clarified. The appalling statistic of 27 million Soviet war losses long concealed the fact that many of them were not Russians and many were victims not of Hitler, but of Stalin. The Black Book of Communism, largely compiled by ex-communists, leaves no doubt concerning the criminal nature of all Soviet-style regimes. Anthony Beevor's dramatic writing about Stalingrad or about Berlin, with its stress on Red Army practices, belongs to the 1990s, and Anne Applebaum's superb study, Gulag, which has taken much of the ill-informed heat out of the subject of Soviet concentration camps, was only published in 2003. In short, it has taken 60 years and more for a body of certainty to accumulate. Naturally, any talk of the Gulag immediately raises fears and anxieties about comparisons with the Holocaust. To my mind, this anxiety is misconceived. Historians cannot be denied the right to compare and contrast, which is one of their basic tools. And in any case, the Holocaust is too well documented to be eroded by comparison. The crucial point here revolves around the distinction between the Nazis' Vernichtungslager, or extermination camps, which had no Soviet equivalent, and the larger category of concentration camps, which had been developed by the Bolsheviks long before the Nazis followed suit. The former, like Treblinka, Sobibor, or Belzec, were straightforward death factories, which made no provision for the sustenance or registration of the condemned. The latter, like Dachau, Belsen, or Auschwitz I, were institutions of penal custody, where the inmates were set to work, and where, as part of the collateral damage, millions perished from maltreatment. The Nazi death camps were unique and were reserved for Jews. The Soviet concentration complexes like Vorkuta or Kolyma were considerably larger and older than their German counterparts. Much confusion has been caused by the fact that the hybrid camp, Auschwitz II, Birkenau, which was a standard concentration camp with extermination facilities attached, has been chosen as the chief memory site of the Holocaust. One can argue endlessly about the similarities and differences of the German and the Soviet systems, and it is obviously a mistake to my mind to equate the two. On the other hand, it's also a mistake to pretend that Stalinist crimes can somehow be absolved because Stalin was a doughty champion of the anti-Nazi cause. As Anne Applebaum underlines, both systems destroyed human beings not for what they had done, but simply for who they were. Both fit the criteria for crimes against humanity. Contrary to what we have been told, the war in Europe was dominated by two monsters, not by one. All of which leaves the Churchillian model of World War II open to revision. Britain can no longer be put in center stage. Its experiences were highly eccentric and untypical. The USA, preoccupied with the war against Japan, cannot be counted prior to 1945 and prior to the explosion of the atomic bomb as the preeminent force in Europe. The Axis powers are joined on the criminal list by the Soviet Union, our ally, which also turns out to be the principal victor. The Western allies cannot be portrayed as all-conquering heroes, but rather as a third party which did well to finish in the winner's enclosure. The Americans arrive too late and in too few numbers to play the dominant role. The forces of democracy certainly play their part in the defeat of fascism, but are left controlling less than half the continent. In the greater part of Europe, one totalitarian tyranny was replaced by another. Alas, more often than not, the rhetoric of freedom and liberation was misplaced. Thank you.
Thank you very much. What do you want to do about your questions?
Well, shall I answer them or shall... Can anybody name the five largest battles of the Second World War in Europe? Kursk is certainly one, yes. Stalingrad is another. Leningrad is a possibility. Leningrad? Lenino. Not so, I think. In the top 10, I think, yes. Monte Cassino, no. Okay, we can go on, but and the actual answer depends on definitions. The Germans use different categories. For example, Operation Barbarossa, the invasion of the Soviet Union in 1941, in Soviet analysis is broken up into three: the Battle of the Borders, the Battle of Encirclement at Minsk, and the Battle of Moscow. But it doesn't matter how you count or which order you put these battles in, all the top 10 battles are on the Eastern Front. D-Day doesn't even get into the top 10. Not even D-Day. Operation Overlord, the whole battle for Normandy, is somewhere in the between 10 and 20. What was the second question? Can anybody, were you awake? Can anybody name?
The biggest concentration camp.
Yes. Vorkuta. Right. How many have not, people here have never heard of Vorkuta? Well, there you are. Not only much bigger than Auschwitz, it was operating from 1931 until 1960. And the third question was, what nationality or perhaps ethnic group suffered the largest number of civilian casualties, i.e. not soldiers killed in combat? But sorry? No. Not Poland. Yes, who was that? Well done. Ukraine. Almost everybody has been led to believe that the Soviet Union was called Russia, which it wasn't. Secondly, the German occupation was mainly in Ukraine, Belarus, and the Baltic states. It only touched the very fringes of Russia. They never captured a major Russian city apart from Rostov on the Don. And in terms of civilians lost, Ukraine was had a higher number than the Russian Republic. But these things are simply not mentioned. A Ukrainian friend of mine said, whenever we did things well, we were called Russians. Whenever we did things that weren't in order, we were called Ukrainians. And there's quite a lot in that. Anyhow, those are just three questions to make you think.
Okay, well, my judgment is that the audience have done just about well enough to earn the right to ask a couple of questions in the other direction.
Fascinated by Philip Hoddle, mm-hmm. in his theory that the next war has its seeds in the peacemaking of the previous war. Do you see that?
Well, there's more than a grain of truth in that, but we're talking about the Second World War. What strikes me about the period immediately after the Second World War, it's usually presented to us that we won the war and then we lost the peace, i.e. we defeated the Third Reich and then we made a mess of the post-war arrangements. I think that's the wrong way of looking about it. I would say that we didn't actually win the war and that the problems which arose afterwards, which became known as the Cold War, were the natural consequence of a Soviet victory. Had we won the war, we wouldn't have lost an empire or ended up bankrupt and all the rest of it. The Americans only asserted their huge potential after the end of the war, when, as you know, Marshall Aid and so on made a huge difference to the western half of Europe. But my answer is there is about the timing. The Americans came in so late that the the effects of their huge resources and so on didn't affect the fighting in the way that we would like to think. And in 1945, in Europe, the Western Allies were on the back foot. The Americans had still got a war to fight against Japan. And as a result, they made concessions to Stalin. Stalin dug in very firmly, and we spent the next 45 years trying to overcome the consequences of the war, not of a badly fixed peace. Right. the question is, why did Stalin put such enormous emphasis on demanding another front? It might have been in his interest to forget it, yeah. I think the answer is that the Soviet Union came very, very close to defeat in 1941. It was within a whisker of being destroyed. And one can go into the mistakes that the Germans made, but they were on the brink of victory. And the idea of a Western Soviet coalition grew out of that critical situation when we were unable to do anything at all. The Soviet armies were... They lost 3 million men in the first winter. You know, just... actually, the Germans killed 2.8 million Soviet prisoners in the first winter of the war because they thought it was all over, that they wouldn't need these people in any way. Later, of course, they were looking for manpower and weren't killing Soviet prisoners out of hand as they did. But Stalin was in desperate straits in 1941-1942. And, of course, he was calling for the Western Front at the first opportunity. It never materialized in 1942. In 1943, when it was promised, again, it never appeared. It only appeared in 1944, by which time the desperate straits of the Soviet Union had been turned into imminent victory. They had a colossal, colossal superiority of numbers and tanks and airplanes and guns. Already sitting on the River Vistula in the summer of 1944 when our Western armies were still landing. We had this huge problem of amphibious warfare. The logistical problem of getting ships and millions of men onto boats and crossing the sea, first of all from North Africa to Sicily and then from Britain to France. It was a colossal obstacle which prevented our side performing in the way that the Red Army performed in the East. And we never really conducted ourselves on a par with this huge Soviet victory on the Eastern Front. I don't say so with any sense of glee. Anybody who knows what it was like to be liberated by the Eastern on the Eastern Front by the Red Army, it was horrific. But it was a horrific, ruthless army in the service of a mass murdering regime, which actually got the upper hand. And that's why the post-war years were much harder than anybody imagined they would be. And the Soviet Union took an awful long time to die. It was impossibly inefficient system, but it had this one moment of glory, namely that all the five-year plans, all the ruthless preparations that Stalin had made since 1929 went into creating a military machine which, despite almost coming to grief, did win the war. And, it's not a story we would like to hear, but I think that's, it's the duty to tell it as it was.